Hello, friends. Welcome back to the What If Project podcast. My name is Glenn, and this is a bonus. I guess it's a bonus episode because we released an episode on Monday. Today's Wednesday. Why not drop another episode? It's my podcast. I can do what I want. But today we're talking to Maria Francesca French. She wrote a book called Reconfiguring, a collection of post-Christian thoughts and theologies. And I wanted to drop this episode midweek. As we're like halfway through, quote, Holy Week, as many of us were brought up with in the church. Good Friday is coming in a couple of days. Then we have Easter over the weekend. And this is a very Jesus-y episode. We talk a lot about Jesus, the cross, Good Friday, theology-type stuff, deconstruction, the origins of deconstruction. And really, like, How do I say it? What good is Jesus these days when we don't believe the things that we used to believe about Jesus, right? Like, if Jesus isn't like our golden ticket out of hell and into heaven, what is he? What is the cross? What is all of this stuff? And so we talk about that. And I don't know about you, but for me, I don't like this week, Holy Week. I was talking to a friend the other day and I said, this is my least favorite time of the year. I drove down the street the other day. There were people on the street corners with their Jesus signs saying you're going to go to hell if you don't believe in Jesus. Jesus rose from the dead. You've got to put your faith in him, all this kind of stuff. You're a sinner. You know, all these different things. I hate this time of year because all of that substitutionary atonement language comes out. And I think there's just so many twisted theologies that I was brought up with in the church and in private Christian school, and even going into Bible college, and it came up in seminary sometimes, and it turns my stomach. And so we talk about that in this episode. I was very honest with Maria, told her some of my story, and she has such a unique way of framing the Jesus story in this book, and also a bit in this episode, and I was like, I gotta drop this episode right before Good Friday, and so that's what we're doing here midweek. So I'm going to put the links to Maria's work and her book in the show notes. Also in the show notes, links to my books, Rethinking Everything, Emerging from the Rubble, and Patreon if you want to support the show financially. That's a place that you can do that. So anyway, let's keep the intro short. Let's roll into this episode 290 with Maria Francesca French. Enjoy. Hey, everybody, welcome back to the podcast. Today, we are joined by a repeat guest, my friend and yours, Maria Francesca French, who's here to talk to us about some ideas from her book, Reconfiguring. It's subtitled A Collection of Post-Christian Thoughts and Theologies. And so, Maria, welcome back to the podcast. I'm excited to have you here.
Thank you. It's always really great showing up on your podcast. Obviously, you're a podcaster, but you're also a friend. And so, it's just always great to be in conversation with you about these things.
Awesome. Yeah, absolutely. So can you start by telling us what this book is? Maybe, you know, it's a collection of essays. So why essays? Where did these essays come from? And how do they kind of feed off of or maybe jump off of your previous book to take us into a deeper layer of the onion?
Yeah, that's actually a really great way of describing it. So my first book, so these two books were actually published 5 months apart from each other to the day, which was sort of really interesting. I didn't plan it like that. That's just sort of the way it happened. But boom, boom. My first book, Safer Than the Known Way, is really like a 30,000 foot look at the post-Christian faith conversation. You know, what does it look like? Why has it started? Why might it be the way forward for kind of pilgrims of Christianity that don't find a home in traditional theism and certainly don't find themselves in the atheist camp? Mm-hmm. You know, what does post-God faith look like? And so I go through all sorts of things. You know, I go through various scriptures, I go through various theologies, especially radical theology. I talk about deconstruction, but I talk about it a la Jacques Derrida, which was really the father of deconstruction, how that word sort of got into the world in the first place, and why like that kind of deconstruction, actual true deconstruction, is Really powerful and transformative, and quite brave and moving when we really sort of get to it. I talk about the decline of Christianity in the West and why that's happening, and really a little bit about my own journey. The first chapter is really autobiographical because while I want my readers to be conversant with new ways of doing theology and engaging God and sort of a faith after belief sort of notion, I suppose. I also want them to know that I've been there and I've gone through it. I'm not just a theologian or a thinker or a philosopher bringing some, lofty, rarefied ideas to the table, but I've actually lived to tell. And so this is the result of not only my story, but, over a decade of sort of blood, sweat, and tears of research and education and travel and conversation and grief and celebration and loss and death and life. And you know what I mean? So that was sort of, the first book I delivered. And I always knew that this was going to be my second book because what I wanted to do was anybody who read Safer, I wanted them to sort of be inspired by it, but also be the sense of, okay, well, how does this shake down into everyday life categories? What does this look like when I have to experience someone close to me die? How do I deal with death and afterlife now that I am sort of post the big God in the sky? What does it look like to love and fall in love? What does it mean to sort of want to pursue happiness? What does it look like to claim to make meaning outside of, a meaning-making God, but still in a Christian narratival way? I deal with various high holy holidays because, again, if you're post the big God in the sky but you're still engaging Christianity, what does it look like to engage Christmas just outside of a traditional sort of Santa Claus or Silent Night level? Like, how is Easter, Good Friday, Palm Sunday, how are all these moments and the high holy calendar not only relevant but deeper than they've ever been for us? I talk about really problematic constructs that, most people find themselves traumatized by, hell or rapture, or so it's really and I delve into, some really important pieces of scripture that I think have been used pretty horribly for probably a lot of more, people coming out of conservative backgrounds. So it's actually 41 essays. It's 40 and an epilogue about what all this looks like, kind of broken down into everyday scenarios. I wanted to offer people that. So I was really excited when it came out. It did really well. I know we're having the conversation. It's end of February, but it came out last June.
We were supposed to have it earlier, but life happens,
Yeah,
right?
life happens. I'm actually working on a new book, which I'm very excited about. I'm not going to reveal the title quite yet. I'm going to sort of be talking about the new book in a reverse way that I did sort of the first one, which means the title will probably be revealed last. But
Nice. I like it.
yeah,
Awesome.
little sneaky.
And these essays are letters to your Patreon supporters, correct?
Yes, thank you for bringing that up. So I've had a Patreon since December 2020. And I used for years, I wrote once a week. And over the last year, I've lessened that to once a month because it's just gotten too much to write really heavy theological content every week with the way I'm publishing now. But the essays for me, I had put so much time and effort into them. And when someone signs up, especially for something like a paid subscription, like I don't take that lightly at all. And I'm, not the kind of person who just, won't sort of reward, I guess, people's faith in me. Do you know what I mean? So even though they're only paying $5 a month for, like, essays that take me hours to write each week, I'm still going to like honor their time and the fact that they're, giving their money and their resources to this platform, and I wanted to sort of give them the best that I could offer. And I did that for years, and I eventually had like over 100, I have over 100 essays, and I just thought, I'm going to take a handful of these and I'm going to publish them because I just think I want them out there in the wider world. So that's sort of, and they're all dated. And while they're in chronological order, you'll see weeks and months skipped at a time because when I published this, I had over 100 and I chose 41. But they are in chronological order. So
What I love
yeah.
about that, though, is like as I was reading it, it felt like you were writing, it was like a letter to me, like addressing a question. that I might have. So it was a very personal way. And I love what you said earlier, even about your first book, about how everything that you write comes from a very personal place, because there are so many writers out there who have really great ideas, and they're fantastic ideas. They're well-researched ideas, but you can almost tell in the reading that, like, they haven't really experienced at a real depth the stuff that they're talking about. Whereas when I'm reading these letters that you're writing, you're sharing stories from your life, you're sharing about how different thoughts have evolved in your life over time. And I think that's such a powerful way to hook somebody in and to really help them see, like, a different perspective. Because, like, I'm living this right now, you've lived this, and now you've evolved to this place. And now that gives me some hope that maybe I can get out of these weeds as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I always wanted to feel like a journey, like not only my Patreon, which I curate to feel like a journey and a community between, me and the people who are signed up there, but anything I offer, certainly in my books, I wanted to feel like we're in this together. And I may be on the other side of, the work in terms of I'm the writer and the author, but like we're all figuring this out and sort of doing it together. And so while I do bring some challenging theological and philosophical concepts to the table, because I think a good author should always challenge their readers, I don't want you to read my books and be like, oh yeah, every single last morsel made sense and I got it all. Why did I even read it? Because I already knew that all in the first place. You should be challenged and you should have some question marks, but you all should also should have, huge moments of resonance and just saying, ah, yes, I see myself in this. I can identify with this. This makes sense. And maybe I don't understand all of it, but I want to keep going because this feels good and this feels right and it's part of my journey. So the letter thing was kind of cool. It just sort of really organically came about because I am writing missives to my Patreon supporters each week or now each month, and I do sign each one. Yours, Maria. Is that how I sign it? Let me
I
see.
think it is.
Until next time, you're Maria's. Yeah. So that's I had to look really quick. So that's how each one ended on Patreon, and I kept that. I was like, I want this to feel casual but intimate. I was writing this for a group of people, and it's still being written for that same group of people. That group has just sort of enlarged now. So,
Yeah, it's really
yeah.
good. Can we back up to something you said earlier? You said you're talking about deconstruction, and you talked about how, and correct me if I'm misquoting you, but something along the lines of, like, deconstruction as it was originally is a little bit different than what we might call pop modern deconstruction. Because I see a lot of people obviously throwing around the word. It's all over the place. And a lot of times I feel like I'll read something, I'm like, I don't really know if how this person or this group is defining deconstruction, doing deconstruction, is really what true deconstruction is. So can you maybe speak a little bit to the differences of those two things?
So I don't want to say that, the modern pop culture conversation on deconstruction is wrong. I mean, people are allowed to take terms and words and reauthor them and make them useful for their own journeys. And I totally get that. But deconstruction is such a striking word, especially sort of in the philosophical community, the latter half of the 20th century and certainly the 21st century, that, when it first rose to the top in the current conversation, me and some friends and some colleagues, we were just like, where this come, like does this have any connection to the work of Jacques Derrida and Mark Taylor and, now John Caputo and all the philosophers and theologians who are sort of using it in a certain way. So in fact, a couple years ago, I did a podcast with John Caputo. I was interviewing him for a podcast I had at the time. And, John, he's just so amazing as a theologian, philosopher, and so prolific with what he's been able to publish in his life and the work he's done. And he was very close with Derrida up until his death in the early 2000s. And so he's done a ton with deconstruction and hauntology and all of these Derridian concepts. And, me and my colleague said to him, we said, do you realize right now that deconstruction is being used at like a very popular level to denote sort of the dismantling and disentwining of toxic fundamental beliefs? And he's like, no, I had no idea, but send me more. I'm so interested that this word is, has been connected in the way. So, I mean, essentially, and just so everyone knows, I have a really big chapter. I believe it's chapter 5 where I talk all about deconstruction. And I do connect it to sort of in Safer Than the Known Way, my first book. I do connect it to modern day conversation on deconstruction. But again, going back to sort of the root of this word and how it has been, used in the past, I always think is really helpful. And so essentially, deconstruction was employed as a literary term, first and foremost, and then was sort of applied to communication. And, you know, anybody who's read a little bit of Derrida knows kind of the famous, I guess, trope or one-liner of, you know, nothing but the text. And it's the sense of everything we need to know is sort of housed within the text, and nothing sort of exists outside of it. And so part of our job is to respect the text in the sense of to get what's at really inside of it. And I remember when I heard these terms for the first time in graduate school and seminary, it really resonated with me, because what I started to learn was, you know, we bring, as readers, as empirical readers, we bring a lot of baggage to the text, you know, what we've heard, what we thought we understood about it, maybe what our pastor has told us about it, something we read about it, historical understandings of it, you know, but what is actually the text constructing for us, you know, that we're not bringing, or are we aware of, like, our presuppositions, you know, are we aware of how it's been, you know, used through the ages, throughout history, throughout, you know, traditional, you know, paradigms and notions and all of that. So it's the sense of, like, really interrogating the text and sort of getting to really kind of what's housed within it. And in order to do that, you sort of have to deconstruct what it's been made to be. Now, if a Derridian scholar were to hear me say all this, they'd be like, okay, that was super reductionistic and a really oversimplified explanation of it. But, you know, just in a couple of words, that is really sort of how deconstruction was really offered up. And then it started sort of being applied to other various philosophical notions. You know, at the end of the 20th century into the 21st century, it started being theologically appropriated, you know, in terms of what does it look like to not even get at, like, the original intent, because that's impossible. But again, almost treating, like, the text and the communication and the thought within the text, which can potentially all be different things, getting to sort of the very root of it all, which essentially is kind of an impossible thing. And so what it does is it keeps us on this journey of a spiral, not a circle, but a spiral that keeps us going. And every time we go around and around to engage the text again, or engage this thing that is open to deconstruction, every time we go around, we find that we are more transformed by it and fall a little bit deeper into it in pursuit of meaning, but also being haunted by everything that we thought we knew about it. So it kind of, the haunting isn't everything. Like, when ghosts haunt, they're sort of like, you know, these annoying little, you know, whatever, maybe gnats sort of flying, you know, around our ears, or they come to us in dreams. And it's just really an essence, really kind of a reminder and a provocation to sort of awaken us to something new. And we follow that. And sometimes it leads us to a dead end, and that's okay. It means that we back up and we go in a different direction, but the journey never ends, because the destination actually is sort of impossible. But again, the search for the impossible is what drives the search. And that's why radical theologians talk all the time about the impossible God as opposed to the possible one, you know, the undeconstructible God as opposed to the deconstructible one, you know, the unnameable, the uncontainable, the unknowable. Which is a very sort of apophatic way of speaking and isn't quite good enough, but language is very broken and it's sort of all we have. So we do our best. And that's part of deconstruction too, is knowing that language is so broken and that it's always just our very best yet feeble attempt to describe something that actually cannot be described in terms at all, which again keeps that journey going forever. And I think the reason why theologians started attaching on to concepts like deconstruction, not the pop culture conversation, because that I wouldn't even say is so much a conversation of theologians as it is sort of everyday, you know, people trying to grapple with their Christian past, which is a wonderful thing. But I think the reason why theologians started grabbing onto this term is because it really invited us into a journey that is completely unending. And that is more about sort of our transformation in the journey, than anything else. And also releasing all sorts of control on anything we might have thought we knew, or anything we thought we could hang our hat on, to sort of never get comfortable in one stage of faith, in a sense. So there's a lot more to say about that. And as you can see, I've just totally word vomited on you.
No, that was perfect. That was perfect. 'Cause As you're talking, I'm thinking about like there's so many times in my story of deconstruction where I've had people from my former tribe like accuse me of, like, well, you're deconstructing, so you're throwing everything away. You're dismantling everything, like there's nothing left, like you've given up on God. I'm like, no, like I feel like for me, my deconstruction journey has been trying to get to a point that I know I can never get to, which is that original intent. I said, but the journey of trying to get there is so fascinating and has only deepened my love and my appreciation for God, the person of Jesus, the scriptures and things like that. Like I think about like, first encountering like Rob Bell's work and his work with Velvet Elvis and Love Wins and things like that. I'm like, wow, this is so interesting to see this take. But then I read through his like bibliography and he mentions this guy, John Dominic Cross. And so I go and get his book. I'm like, oh, this is even more interesting. And then Cross mentions like a Bart Ehrman. I go get his some of his books. I'm like, oh, this is even more interesting. But I'm just going down this rabbit hole where I'm not abandoning the Bible. I read the Bible still almost every day, but I feel like I have a much deeper appreciation for it. That it's no longer this book of systematic theologies where I take these random verses to build this ivory tower that I can sit in and tell myself that I'm right because that's what I used to do. But now I'm like, I'm digging deeper beneath that tower, trying to get to like the root of what these different stories really meant and what these authors really meant. And I know I can never get there because, like you said, that's impossible, but it's the journey of trying to get there that's so fascinating to me.
It is the journey of trying. And I think that's why, like, when people ask me, like, why post-Christianity, why the Christianity in post, like, why not just be out of it altogether? And I think everyone has to ask answer that question for themselves. And some people do choose to get out of it altogether. Some people are, rightly wanting to be atheists, or maybe more palatable agnostics. But for me, or someone who would have this sort of mindset, is that this isn't a departure, really. It's just the next step of pursuing the curiosity and imagination that has always driven my faith.
It's so good. All right, one of the questions I wanted to ask you, the biggest question I wanted to ask you today, is because at the time of this recording, we're approaching Easter, we're in the season of Lent. And so
Yes, we are.
a lot of people are writing about and thinking about, especially in the world of deconstruction, like what do I believe about the cross these days? What do I believe about Jesus and all these different kind of things? And you have this one line in the book, and I wrote it here on my screen. You say something along the lines of, when it comes to Jesus and the cross, you didn't leave the cross behind, nor did you nail yourself to it. And I think that's such a thought-provoking statement that I've had swirling in my mind really ever since I read it. But I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about, especially in this time of the year, like what are your thoughts about Jesus, the cross, atonement, like all those different things? Maybe like, where were you with all that stuff in the past? Where are you today? And what was it like to get from A to
Yeah, it's more like A to X, or A to or at very least A to T, or something like this.
Something like that.
Just not Z, because Z's not fun. It's funny that we're having this conversation now, because I am like knee deep in Lenten study, and God, I hate to use the word meditation. What's the word that I want, Glenn? Lenten
Lenten,
exploration,
mysterious
just kind of
exploration. I like that.
just kind of sitting with it. And it's funny, because Lent hits me sort of really different every year.
Contemplation. How's that?
Okay,
All
the
right, there we
better.
go.
Maybe that was the word I was searching for. Really deep into Lenten contemplation at the moment. The last, I'd say, 2 to 3 years of Lent, for me, it was all about death, and sort of memento mori, and thinking on mortality often, and sort of switching it really from an evangelical mentality on thinking about death often, because an evangelical or a fundamental idea of death, or at least death motivating towards life, is eternal life. This world is not all there is, and it's just a blip, and you're going to die sooner than you think, and so live for eternal life, but live with death in mind. And ever since I sort of came out of that faith mindset, which has been many years now, but it's also taken me many years to sort of explore the other side of that, is that I'm still thinking on death, but the script has been flipped in a sense. Now I think on death, not because I'm looking forward to what's after death, but because life is so valuable and we only get this one bit of life. And so how am I going to honor it and live it well? But this year I'm kind of in a Jesus season, which is interesting because I don't want to, this is going to sound so crude, but I kind of go in and out of my times engaging with Jesus. I'm always ready to talk about Jesus because I think it's super important to do. I'm always ready to sort of talk about the cross and the resurrection. And that's one thing that I really tout a lot in this post-Christian conversation is there's a reason why we're post-Christian. There's a reason why we're still using that word Christian. You know, we're still sort of orbiting around the central figure of Jesus of Nazareth, Jesus Christ. And what does that mean in the 21st century? We've got to figure it out. Like, and a lot of times when we move into a more progressive situation with Christianity, Jesus sort of gets really dumbed down. You know, he starts to look like a hippie that gardens and eats organic food and, you know, love your enemies and do justice. And those things are really important. Those are integral Christian teachings. The issue is when you only talk about that stuff, Jesus is nothing more than, you know, a basic faceless humanitarian and freedom fighter, which is fine. But it's not quite as distinctive as Christianity actually is. And so in that post-Christian conversation, you know, I'm always about, well, why does all of this stuff still matter in terms of distinctly Christian? And I think Lent is a really good time to sort of think on some of that, to engage some of that, even if we don't have the answers, because we don't always. And sometimes the answers are uncomfortable, or maybe they're, we think they're the wrong answers or whatever. But I think when we look at, so in terms of your question, how I used to engage versus how I engage now, I don't think I have to sort of, you know, extrapolate the whole kind of evangelical notion of a personal savior and why I've moved on from that. And I talk a lot about in both of my books, why I think having a personal relationship with Jesus is actually superfluous and really completely unnecessary in a public way. That is to the true and central mission of Christianity and the radical imperatives of the New Testament. So I would say, like, at this stage in my life, rather than wanting to sort of be the, you know, the Mary at his feet or the beloved disciple that, you know, reclines next to him in his, you know, shoulder blades at the Last Supper, as we see in John, I'm more wanting to sort of, you know, be Nicodemus, who's like hanging at the top of the tree, just trying to get a view, or, you know, I don't want to be one of the women or James at the foot of the cross, like, you know, crying and sort of being soaked in sweat and blood, like in the storm. I kind of want to be further away as I'm trying to sort of make out what Jesus might be uttering to, you know, the thieves on either side of him, and sort of being a little mystified by that and wondering what it all means and why this is happening. And, you know, I don't want to be a forerunner, like waving palms as Jesus is coming into Jerusalem, but I kind of want to be in the middle of the city and being like, oh, okay. You know, here we have a Roman prefect like entering one side of Jerusalem, you know, victory in battle. And on this side, we have this guy who claims to be a Jewish Messiah coming in on a donkey. Like, what is going on? You know what I mean? So it's sort of like backing away and sort of observing and like asking more questions rather than coming to the table with these really neatly fitted answers, because, you know, the truth is there are no neatly fitted answers. You know, Jesus dies on a cross alone. You know, he's looking for his disciples, which we can see, you know, at the night of Gethsemane, you know, fell asleep when all he wanted to do was not be alone. All he wanted was, you know, sit up and pray with me. In fact, a little shameless plug, I don't know when this is going to air, but in April, my publisher Choir is coming out with a compilation on Jesus. And I am one of the contributing authors, and my chapter is called Jesus Relic or Radical. And I engage Jesus the night in Gethsemane, because I think that we pass over that a lot in favor for like the more quote unquote important story of the cross and the resurrection. But, you know, he's asking, you know, his God and his Father, like, I don't really want to die. Can this cup just pass from me? Is it possible? Like, he starts sweating blood, which is a real medical condition that is like induced by the ultimate stress, you know, that you can think of, you know, going into, you know, the trial, and Pontius Pilate sort of offering up his verdict, and letting sort of the people, Jesus knows he has like no hope. Up on the cross when he's crying out to God, and the heavens are just, they've just closed. Like, this God has just vaporized into the background, has totally abandoned, Jesus. It's what the likes of Slavoj Žižek calls an atheist moment for Jesus on the cross. And then you have this hope of the resurrection, which is a really sort of powerful and highly Jewish in terms of an eschatological hope and narrative that came out of the end of Second Temple Judaism to give people hope as ethnic Israel was just sort of being, annihilated under foreign rule and occupation. By the time Jesus makes it onto the scene in the first century, we have two tribes out of the 12 left, and they're desperately trying to hold on to their sense of national and ethnic identity. And resurrection really meant something to them much more than, any Western concept of like, oh, someday we'll be resurrected and we'll kind of leave the earth and kind of go to heaven. It was actually a real thing, and it was really powerful, and people didn't use that language unless it was true. And that's why you have the disciples saying, well, what, was it his angel? Was it his ghost? They understood those to say resurrection was like, you don't really mean resurrection, do you? Because that means something has started, something that we've been waiting to really, so it's like, these things are so amazing and so powerful and so transformative, but we sell ourselves short. We sell scriptures short. We sell, the Judeo-Christian narrative short, when we engage them in sort of these really one-dimensional, propositional, systematized, ways of doing theology that is incredibly anemic and unhelpful. So, I mean, I've just gotten super passionate about it. But this is just like one little way you can engage Jesus outside of personal savior narratives, which I don't think are super helpful. Right now, like I said, I'm sort of knee deep in some Lenten thoughts where I'm really kind of focusing on the way the Apostle John, in his gospel, focuses on his relationship with Jesus, because we're told that this was the beloved disciple and potentially an eyewitness, irrespective of what you want to say about dating. And this is why taking the text on the text terms is so important, because it throws the need for dating out the window, because we're not so concerned with the dating. We're concerned with what, irrespective of who empirically wrote this narrative, we want to know what this narrative is trying to tell us about Jesus.
That's right.
And that's the important thing. And so we take the text on the text terms. We respect it. We can question it. We can challenge it. It can handle it. It can, it's totally up for the challenge. But really kind of seeing what Jesus was communicating during this time of Lent, starting, with, well, not starting with, because Lent came, the time we know as Lent came much later, but like even when he's calling the disciples, and when John the Baptist is, switching his mantle to the mantle of Christ, and what that means, going from the law to like the, not only the law giver, but like the law fulfiller. And what happened in Jesus? Do we see the end of religion? Do we see like the ultimate fulfillment of meaning? Do we see like, no longer do we need sacrifice, no longer do we need like religious ritual, like no longer do we need even like religious paradigms and all of this. Like, it's actually quite radical when you really get into it. And so for me, I'm sort of knee deep in that thought now, and you can expect to, that's going to be showing up on my Patreon for the next several weeks for sure. But again, it's just small examples, not small. They're quite mind-blowing, but like just a few really of the amazing ways we can engage Jesus and Christianity outside of that personal savior motif.
Yeah, I love all of that because I was thinking this past week about my history in the church, especially during this time of the year. And I can't tell you how many times, like, we had a Good Friday service in my churches growing up. And I went to a private Christian school, so we had like Good Friday services there as well. And in so many of those services, especially in the last church I was at, what we would do is we get together on Good Friday. There'd be a giant wooden cross at the front of the room. The lights are all dim, so it's really dark when you go in. There's like red floodlights on the walls, to make it like that creepy kind of bloody feeling. There's really low music playing. The
Oh,
pastor
yes.
gets up, has a very short, dull kind of monologish sermon.
Yeah.
And then, the band comes and they play this very low song, and they invite you to write your sins on a note card and go up to the front. There's this 400 people, so it's a long line, and you take a hammer and a nail and you nail your sin to the cross. And so literally for like 40 minutes, all you hear in the sanctuary is this banging of a hammer, and it's all the theology that's given is about, our sin and about, God's anger towards sin and all these different things. And I can remember even like pre-deconstruction thinking to myself, like, there's gotta be more
Yeah.
than this. Like, this just seems like we've taken this story that for whatever reason has endured for 2,000 years to the point
Yeah.
where it's still on my shelf and your shelf and everybody's shelf in many places growing dust. Sometimes we read it all the time, whatever, but that story has endured. Like, what is it about this story that has captured people's attention for so long? And so I love like what you were saying about like you find yourself being, like and like these different characters in
Yeah.
the stories and like looking at Jesus from there. And I'm finding myself these days like in the Nicodemus kind of place where I go to Jesus like at night and I feel like I'm asking him like, what exactly is your deal? Like, who, what did you mean when you said this? And like, why did you do this? And like, what is it about this story? Like, I'm asking all these different kinds of questions. And even though I feel like I don't, even like Nicodemus, like I go away not really still understanding, like he comes up later in the story, right? Because he's there later on in the story. He's there at the end of the story. Like he still sticks around. And I feel like I'm saying to Jesus, like, I don't understand you, but I'm going to stick around because I feel like you have really good things to share. And I feel like, going back to what you said before about deconstruction, about continuing to dig through that mystery and becoming more and more comfortable with the unknowing of things that I feel like I used to know, and allowing those feelings to just wash over me and be like a wave that propels me into the next seasons of my life with Jesus. So that's what I feel like I'm at right now with the cross and all the different things. I have no answers. I have no solid, theologies. I just enjoy the story and the mystery and the wonder, and that's what I'm trying to embrace this Easter of 2024.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's wonderful. And if there's one thing the Gospels don't do is they don't put pressure on us to know and to
That's
have it
right.
all figured out. Like we're allowed to be on a journey. And as I look at the disciples that Jesus called, they were, if you really look at how they all interacted, like one by one, if you don't like, just mesh them together as a group of disciples, but if you really look at like each one's interaction with Christ throughout the Gospels, like at one time or another, we could probably all see ourselves like as, we were Peter at one point, and then we were Andrew, and then we were John, and maybe even sometimes we were Judas. And do you know what I mean? Because they all have such different reactions to them.
That's
And
right.
he has different relationships with each of them. Like he asks them different questions. He responds to them differently. I mean, I think it's okay to identify with, like we were just saying a moment ago, different characters in the narratives, but also to sort of bring your own character to the narrative as well. I just said what the Gospels don't do, but one thing the Gospels absolutely do is invite us in, I think, to sort of be key players and key actors in the story, and to keep the story going, to
That's
keep the
right.
writing of it.
That's right. So good. Maria, we're just about out of time, but this has
Yeah.
been a blast. So thank you
We
for.
were really Bible-y today. Normally,
We
I'm like
were
usually on the more
Jesus-y and
theological
Bible-y and
side.
spirity. Look at us. Who would have
I'm a
thought?
bit in my Jesus era at the moment, and it sounds like you are too. So it's all
Yes.
right. So this
Who would
was
have
great.
thought?
Thank you.
Yes, it's a lot of fun. Real quick, anywhere you want to point people to, any kind of social media, any kind of specifics of your work you want people to go check out?
Kind of the one-stop area really for everything I'm involved in is my website, which is mariafrancescafrench.com. I have a Pathos links there. I have my Patreon column there. I do other things with other organizations. It's all there. My books, any chapters I'm writing or being a part of, it's all there. And especially if you want to get in touch with me, say hello, follow me on social media, just head to the website. It's all linked.
Awesome. All the links are in the show notes, and we'll do it again sooner than the last time. All
Indeed.
right.